supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The American small town. Well, I say that, and I'm sure it can conjure up images of ice cream socials and turkey dinners at the local church. Simple living with close neighbors. Ah, that's kind of the ideal fantasy, isn't it? Yet, social scientists tell us that neighborliness that I'm describing is down quite a bit in America across the board. In fact, even in those tiny, desirable hamlets. In fact, an article last week in Newsweek magazine about social inequality points out that we trust each other less than we used to. We have less political awareness, certainly less political involvement, and there is less civic engagement. In other words, Americans seem to have, according to this article, less social capital. But what is it, really? Boil it down, and it's really about the connections we create that lead us to the things we value. For example, voting is social capital. So is keeping up with friends and neighbors. It has many forms, and we're going to be talking about some of them today in terms of how social capital affects our voice and our quality of life and well-being. I've got two guests, Brian Jones and Jody Hornfett. Brian is a professor of sociology at Villanova University. He's written Social Capital in America, Counting Buried Treasure. It's now out in paperback, and he's here in the studio with me. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Dr. Dan.
And Jody Hornfett is a community vitality, leadership, and civic engagement educator at the University of Minnesota Extension, and she's on the phone from Minnesota. Jody, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here as part of the program today.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and we really do want to hear from you today. Tell us what connections you have in your life, how they work, perhaps how they've changed over the years, how they do or don't contribute to your well-being. Let us know what you do to develop civic engagement in your community or what needs to be done. We really do want to know. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Jody, let's start with you. Let's understand this whole concept of social capital. After all, it sounds like a very academic construct to my lowly clinician's ears. So what is it really? Personalize it for us.
Well, you know, when I think of social capital, I sometimes explain to people it's kind of like one of those dot-to-dot books that you have when you're a kid and you have to connect those dots. And for me, it's like people are those dots, and it's those connections between the dots that bring people together. I sometimes share with people, I think it's like the glue that holds people in communities together.
Huh. Brian, could you tell us how you would define social capital?
Well, I've constructed a model of social capital incorporating four areas of life: work, family life, voluntary association, which is another academic buzzword, but simply means group membership in the community, and finally, social networks, our primary interactions with relatives, friends, and neighbors. That's the model, and certainly what you said at the outset about neighborliness is incorporated into it, But I think it's important to look at all those different zones of life before drawing conclusions.
Yeah, and I want to get to that because you've got some interesting takes in your book and when we spoke to you earlier. Brian, this discussion really does start with your book came across our desk and a YouTube of a lecture you gave to your Villanova student. So it begins really when political scientist Robert Putnam wrote Bowling Alone 10 years ago and was wildly popular. It's a book that paints a pretty bleak picture, frankly, of our social connections. Now, I'm going to put this mildly, Brian. You've got a problem with the book. I see that smirk over there. So you argue that things really aren't as bad as Putnam suggests.
Yes, and I think it's interesting that the public mood seems receptive to books like Putnam's. Americans generally think that American society is falling apart. So I think that's part of the reason Putnam was received the way it was received. To be honest, the book electrified me. I looked at it. Brilliant title. I mean, Bowling Alone is based on the idea that more Americans than ever before are bowling, which is a commentary on social decline as well. But in fact, fewer than ever are members of bowling teams. So his thematic was that, in effect, Americans were becoming less socially committed, less socially involved, pretty much across the board. And it was a pretty impressive board. He marshaled a lot of data over a lot of years. I think that's what made me build my model. If you separate any one piece, you may get a misleading picture of what's going on. But putting together the actual fabric of people's lives, I think you need to take into account, well, for example, involuntary association. Maybe people are joining fewer groups, but spending more time with friends. Is that a net loss? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's tough to tell. As a clinician, I would say the same thing. I want to follow that up with you and perhaps challenge that a bit. So is that true? Do we know that's true? People are less involved with groups. That we know. Are they spending more time with friends?
People are spending more time with friends.
How do we know that?
The timeline in my data source, the General Social Survey, starts in 1972. If you look at the actual amount of time people spend with friends, and I'm not just talking about cell phone calls, the language of the General Social Survey over all that span of time was, how often do you spend a social evening? With friends, with relatives, with neighbors. And that spending a social evening with friends has increased each of the past three decades.
Wow. Well,
also, I'd back you up a second on the question of whether, in fact, we are less associational. It is true in the aggregate that there has been what I would call a slight decline in voluntary association. But most of it is that the biggest single drop in Americans joining groups is unions. And the fact is, the reason the union movement has lost steam and therefore people have gotten less involved in union groups is because the union jobs are now elsewhere, have been outsourced. So it isn't that Americans suddenly became less groupy. There's been a substantial decline in unions. There has been a significant decline in religious affiliation. But in the aggregate, if you ask people how many groups they're members of, the decline since 1972 is surprisingly slight.
I would ask a different question, and that's how many groups are you active in? And I think that's a different question. Let me turn to you, Jody. What's your take on what's happening? After all, you've been doing this for 20 years, so you've got a wider perspective also.
Well, I think from the communities that I see where I live here in Northwest Minnesota, That sense of people needing to find ways to connect to each other and to get things done is becoming more and more prevalent. I think you see more and more community gardens. You see the need for nonprofit groups to form to compensate for sometimes lack of funding to accomplish things to support their neighbors. And I do see people with much more interest in finding ways to come together to help and support each other. Over the years, that I think that is shifting.
That was Jody Hornvet. She's a community vitality, leadership, and civic engagement educator. She's at University of Minnesota. We're talking about social capital today with her and Brian Jones, who's a professor of sociology at Villanova University. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Are you joining groups? Are you a member of many? And do you attend? Are you spending more time with friends or less over the last few decades? Let's go to the phones. We've got Sue on the line. Sue, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
I wish you'd address this point, which upsets me a lot. I go through neighborhoods, and it seems all the front porches have disappeared. People congregate on the back porches or on the back of their houses. When I grew up, we had a front porch, and everybody who passed by came up to visit. That is no longer the case. Do you notice that the neighborhoods have no more front porches?
Yeah, actually, there was. I read an article many years ago written by a sociologist by that exact same title. It said, From the Front Porch to the Back Deck. And that was exactly the point that sociologist made. And it really illustrates where we are. I'm curious, Brian, what's your take on that? And thanks for your call, Sue.
Well, the caller is certainly correct. One of the ways I'm forced to agree with Putnam is that there has been a substantial decline in neighboring, defined just the way I defined interaction with friends. How often do you spend a social evening with? So that doesn't catch porch walk-bys. But wherever you look, and I mean in small towns, suburban areas, or big cities, neighboring in America is truly down.
Jody, do you find that in smaller communities too?
I'm not certain that in smaller communities I see that being maybe down quite as much. When I define smaller communities as well, the ones I'm familiar with, you know, under 1,000 people. And this notion of knowing your neighbors, knowing who you can rely on if you need somebody to help with something, people are looking out for each other. And that notion of a front porch, I think is really an important concept to think about, that if you're sitting out there, you know your neighbors, they stop by, they chat, you get to know each other and recognize people, whether that's in a small rural community or even in some of our suburban neighborhoods.
Well, and, you know, big cities have... Big cities have small communities, too, in them. I wonder about the psychological implications of having neighbors and small communities who you know, who know you, whether you're close or not, but you can trust will look out for you. I would imagine that would correlate pretty highly with one's sense of well-being. Jody, are you aware of any research on that?
On the well-being factor, not in particular, but one of the community assessments that we have developed here in Minnesota looks at how you trust your neighbor, how much you trust, and correlates that to your willingness then to engage with them. And if we could make any changes at all, it would be finding places for individuals to develop trust in each other and build that level of trust so that they are willing to step in and engage.
Brian... psychoanalyst Frieda Fromm-Reichman, and I've quoted this on the show, said that alienation is the scourge of society, and if it gets worse, we're all in trouble. And Frieda Fromm-Reichman was a Jewish German psychoanalyst, and she said that in 1935, And I think it's gotten worse. I think lack of neighborliness will increase one's sense of alienation.
Yeah, related to alienation, of course, as you mentioned before, is trust.
Right.
And I'll be honest, I certainly haven't figured out the causes and effects of this cascade downward of neighboring, but it runs in parallel to another general social survey question, which is generally, can people be trusted? Yes or no? And that has fallen off the shelf in conjunction with neighboring.
Yeah. Yeah, that's deeply, deeply troubling. So I want to come back to your source of information. Like you said, it goes back 40 years. And one of the things you found is that friendship is up over the last four decades. And that's pretty surprising to me. The American Sociological Review, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, Brian, reported that the average number of people with whom Americans could discuss important matters dropped from 3 to 2 over the last 20 years, and the number of Americans who felt they had no confidants at all more than doubled. It's now up to 25% of the people in this country have no confidants at all. So how do I understand both findings? They seem contradictory.
2 points. First, there has been some controversy about that study, but that's a little too academic. Second, the fact is that is asking about a particularly intense set of social bonds. People with whom you can, quote, discuss important personal matters, they're your tightest folks. The measure that I've been relying on, for which we have data every year or every other year, is how often do you spend a social evening with? So it's possible people have smaller groups of confidants but are interacting with them more.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Roger on the line. Hey, Roger.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I enjoy this your discussion greatly. I own a little cafe in West Philadelphia, and one of the things that I'm inspired by is a book or concept by Ray Oldenburg called The Third Place, and you're sort of talking about that it seems like we have a need to have our where we live and a place where we work, but I think psychically we really need a third place, a place to hang out or a place to run into people on a casual basis. And I think that we're losing that a lot of the time because we live in gated communities or whatever. And I just think I don't know how you feel about this notion of the third place.
Yeah,
I love my cafe for the fact that people can just come in, and if they run into somebody they know, they can talk to them or not as they wish.
Yeah, because that becomes a third place. And as I listen to you, Roger, and I listen to what Brian said, you know, that third place used to be the church or the union hall
or the barbershop.
Or the barbershop or the bowling league coming back.
Right.
So I'm curious. Let me turn to you, Jody. What are your thoughts about that third place? And thanks for your call, Roger. And listen, as a human, thanks for what you do. You're really doing a good service for your fellow humans.
I agree wholeheartedly with what Roger was saying in that third place. We've done interviews with people in communities talking about that very thing, and many times it's now the local coffee shops that are springing up or businesses that are providing or finding that space within even a business for people to gather if it's not available in the church or maybe sitting in the school watching your children take part in sports activities, whatever that may be. But having that third place, people have told us we don't invite strangers over to our house. We have to get to know them first. And so that sense of neighborliness can sometimes be formed in that third place where you get to know each other on a very basic level. And then as you engage with them more, you become friends and develop those friendships, and you start inviting people over.
I'm going to open up a can of worms, and we've only got a minute before we have to go to break, Brian. But is Facebook the third place?
Well, Facebook, online interaction, emailing. Of course, the stalking fear is that we're all going to disappear into our computers and not be connected to each other. My own research indicates the opposite. People who are moderately involved with Facebook and online, in fact, spend more time, more face-to-face interpersonal time than folks who are not online or do so less. So it's a complex picture, but it looks like there's not necessarily a choice between Facebook and the third place in the real world.
That's interesting. I want to follow up on that. Like I said, we've got to take a short break. We're talking about social capital, what it is, what its implications are, and what we could do to improve it in our lives. We're talking with Brian Jones, a professor of sociology at Villanova, and he's written Social Capital in America. It's now out in paperback. Judy Hornvet is a community vitality leader and civic engagement educator at the University of Minnesota Extension. Jody, that is one heck of a title. We're going to have to unpack that in the second half of our show. Anyway, we would love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tell us about relationships in your life. Do you have many? Do you have enough? Do you have too many? And how do you connect with the people in your lives? Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY. IBC is proud to launch the new Independence Blue Cross Foundation, whose mission is to transform healthcare in the communities they serve. The foundation's Blue Safety Net program provides $2 million in grants to local nonprofit health clinics that offer quality healthcare for the uninsured in our communities. The foundation supports more than 30 clinics that care for more than 145,000 individuals in underserved areas. To learn more, visit ibxfoundation.org.
Tomorrow night, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Block. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about social capital, that all-important thing about relationships, connections with humans and institutions that give us our sense of meaning and well-being and, frankly, help make the world a better place. We're talking with Brian Jones and Jody Hornvet, and our number is 888-477-9499. Brian, you talked about that survey. It started in 1973. I started practicing psychology in 1970, around the time that survey began. And from my perspective, as a clinician, I see a dramatic increase in anxiety and insecurity within ourselves, and anxiety about the future. I mean, you talked about everybody being afraid of the computer, and I think part of the computer's energy is because people are afraid of what goes on outside of the house. We see the ramifications of that anxiety. Most people, and you know from surveys, most people live with stress. Most people don't get enough sleep. Most people don't eat well or exercise. And I mean, that's about our anxiety and insecurity, how we push ourselves and push ourselves. And my experience as a clinician is that when anxiety goes up, the lens of our focus gets more narrow, not more broad. So I'm seeing as a clinician more alienation and not less.
And well, there are many ways you can define alienation. One broad perspective, also in the context of the general social survey, is happiness. There is a question that is so direct it seems disarmingly dumb, which is, taking all things together, how happy would you say you are with your life? Over this broad span of 40-some years, there's been very little change. And that doesn't necessarily pick up clinical anxiety or pathology. But again, like many things I looked at, the changes in American life aren't as revolutionary as they feel. But I think the anxiety dimension is the reason we feel that way and why we think things are going to hell.
Joe, do you have a take on that, on the level of anxiety and its implications? Do you think that perhaps, and I wonder this too, am I looking at it through the eyes of a clinician who sees mostly people who suffer?
I'm not sure I've thought about it through the lens of anxiety. I look at it through the multiple stressors in people's lives these days. Looking at, you know, multiple, you know, family members being employed and the amount of time that they have to spend focused on relationships, I think, is decreased. And if you translate and call that anxiety, then I would agree that there's more of that going on. But I think there's a lot more to it maybe than just that.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Sue on the line. Hey, Sue.
Oh.
Hi, Sue.
I really love your show.
Thanks, me too.
My comment is that I belong to an animation convention that I work for. We meet once a year. The corporation that puts the animation convention on is a 501c3 educational, but I've been working with this corporation for 15, 16 years, and it has become like a family. There are people there, you know, it's not always good. Sometimes there's the crazy aunts and uncles, but it definitely, I know there are people there who don't have any family other than us at the convention.
So
I'm wondering about...
Go on.
No, go ahead.
That's social capital for
yes.
you. And I wonder, Brian, is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's certainly part of what I'm talking about. One of the other little rivulets in the data that I've been identifying and trying to figure out this neighboring thing is interaction with coworkers, which, even though in many respects that is the first place, it can also be a third place when people strike up real human relationships with coworkers.
I wanted to follow that. Sue, thanks so much for your call. I wanted to follow that up, and with both of you. We're working more. We're taking vacations. And you pointed this out in your lecture on YouTube. Less than any other, we're taking less days off work than any other culture, almost. And, you know, we're driving ourselves terribly. And at the same time, and this might be related, there's no loyalty anymore between employees and work and, you know, employers and employees. So I would think that's got to affect work relationships, I would think.
Well, if you're working 80 hours a week, there's certainly very little time to interact with neighbors, and you're right there in the carrel next to a guy that might become a friend. Yeah, you're certainly right, too, about the trends in work behavior. We are, in fact, the hardest working people on the planet, or at least the parts of the planet for which we have data. We passed the Japanese in about 2000, and even through the Great Recession, our hours of work averages have been sustained. And yes, you're also right that we are certainly the worst vacationers on the planet. We have allocated less than half the amount of time of the Japanese, who are the second worst vacationers on the planet.
Well, not only have we allocated less, but I read another survey where most people don't even take the vacations they have, and when they do, they take their computers.
Yeah. In 2009, 400 million vacation days went unclaimed, even with the relative pittance that we already have allotted.
I wonder what the work environment. Unemployment's pretty bad, Jody. I want to turn to you. What about social connections at the work environment in smaller towns and rural communities?
The work connections that I see there is when people, you know, high levels of poverty in rural areas as other places as well. But in times like that, having those people you can rely on can be just a godsend and a blessing for people to be able to help and support each other and get the help that they need. And again, they're not willing to always ask for that help. So there becomes this difficult situation where when people are in need, if they don't have a relationship with someone, they're afraid to ask. Hmm. And so if we can focus on building social capital in our communities so that people have that level of trust to go to someone when they need that help. Because if they're outside of a work environment, outside of the social capital of work, and maybe they're not involved in a church and there's not a third place in a community for people to gather, it can be devastating for those individuals to not have those connections.
How can they be forged?
How can they be forged?
Yeah.
I think that if communities really want to take on something, one thing they could focus on is how do we build those kinds of relationships between people? How can we be on the lookout? How can we put together, maybe it's a circle of support of some type, where different people with different interests might be on the lookout and be willing to reach out to people.
All right, let me push you further because, you know, like I said, I'm a clinician and I, you know, don't make it too complex for me or else I get nervous here. So how do we do that? You raised a lot of questions. How do we do that?
Well, it's taking the time. It goes. I think it's as basic as just getting to know your neighbor. I know someone who moved into a new community and had not lived there before. She was single and wanted to get to know the neighbors because where she'd come from before, there was a lot of that neighborliness going on. But no one came by to say hi. No one stopped by to invite her to anything or do anything. And 3 months later, she took it on her own and said, you know what, I'm gonna host an ice cream social here at my house. And she took a little invitation, and she walked and hand-delivered them to everyone in the neighborhood in that, you know, that little general area and invited them to her house. And I thought that example was so, you know, there in my mind, like the community themselves could have been wrapping their arms around people and finding a way to welcome people. But instead, it took this person from outside the community who moved in. That's one example of what we can do as a community to begin building that type of network and connection.
So if you want something to change, you have to do something different.
You might need to think about that. That you suggested earlier my title needed unpacking. Well, the civic engagement side of me focuses all about that. Sometimes we have to unpack things and think about how we can get engaged civically in a variety of ways in our community.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jessica on the line. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
My comment was that I live in a housing project.
Uh-huh.
It's full of mostly single moms, and there is like a really great sense of community there. And I was just wondering if that is that has anything to do with everybody just generally knowing that, you know, we're a part of the same socioeconomic class.
Kind of kindred spirits.
Yes, you know, dealing with very similar issues, as, you know, as far as parenting and money matters and things like that is very similar.
Tell us a little bit about what happens in that community, what those relationships are like. Do you do things together?
Yeah, especially with the kids. There's a park in the community. And all the moms kind of go there, and, you know, everybody looks out for each other's kids. So, you know, like, one mom might be able to leave to get something done, and there's always another mom there to take over. Actually, at my house on Thursday nights, because we live, like, so our doors are so close together, we'll usually put the kids to bed. And we'll sit, and we'll, you know, we might have a few drinks, and we'll have dinner, and we'll just talk. And, you know, and our kids are always just an earshot away because we live so close. So there's, like, a real sense of camaraderie, you know. And,
What a wonderful story, and what a beautiful way to dispel horrible stereotypes about
yeah.
housing projects. Great work, Jessica. I'm curious about what our experts have to say about kindred spirits, because Jessica, as I listen to you, I know the research about how healing being with kindred spirits can be, however you define them. On the other hand, you know, we've got more people moving closer, we're blending more, so I wonder if that's part of the solution or part of the problem. Brian, your thoughts, and thanks for calling, Jessica.
I guess you're referring to me as an expert, but I'll continue.
Okay.
The social networks literature, which was my bastion for decades, demonstrates conclusively my grandmother's commonsensical point that birds of a feather do, in fact, flock together. I think the caller we just heard is a perfect example. People who share circumstances and then start to share each other's lives.
Yeah, I agree. And we see that in, I see it in the disability community personally, and I see it on the online disability community, getting back to computers. I'm very involved with the Christopher Reeve webpage, and that's like a family, and it feels like a family. And I see it in the mental health community and self-help groups. Look at the 12-step programs. You know, and I think just to be with kindred spirits, that alone is healing. It helps kind of stabilize and normalize.
Even professors who need normalizing.
I don't think I want to comment on that. Jody, any thoughts?
I think the phrase that comes to mind for me, whether it's birds of a feather or kindred spirit, it's common interest.
Yeah.
And sometimes that does cross socioeconomic boundaries. It surpasses generational differences, whatever that might be. Whether it's learning some type of a craft that can benefit people, whether it's an interest in children, whether it's an interest in books or reading, music, whatever that might be. I think that common interest is really what can begin pulling people together.
Well, we've got to take a short break, but just to follow up on that comment, for the moments after 9/11, we were all kindred spirits for that moment. We're talking about social capital here on Voices in the Family, or connections in our communities and our lives, what they mean to us, what they do for us, and how we can help ourselves and others improve their social capital. My guests are Judy Hornvet, a community vitality leadership and civil engagement educator at the University of Minnesota Extension. Brian Jones is a professor of sociology at Villanova. He's written Social Capital in America, Counting Buried Treasure. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Cullen Murphy about his new book, God's Jury, on the history of the Inquisition. Some of the interrogation techniques used today got their start in the 13th century.
What today we would call the good cop, bad cop, that's laid out by the medieval inquisitors in exactly the same way.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about social capital, social connections with Jody Hornvet and Brian Jones. Brian, I wanted to follow up something with you about this lack of neighborliness. There's crime anxiety is high, getting higher and higher. And I know the statistics are that crime has gone down, I believe. But I wonder if that affects our lack of joining and lack of neighborliness, that we've become afraid of our neighbors.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradox, really. If you look at the actual crime statistics by any objective measure, they are significantly, I was tempted to say, massively down since about 1980. Despite that fact, there has been, as I already said, a cascading drop of trust and crime concern, crime fear, crime anxiety, pick your term, is certainly up. But it clearly is not connected to the actual reality of crime in America.
24-hour news cycle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's no, I don't want to sound like Newt, but there's no way to avoid the media here. Certainly people's perceptions, I think, of the collective crime problem are, if not drawn from, at least inflamed by the media.
Yeah, and that's what they do. I mean, that's the definition of news. I heard a speaker years ago who said, you know, what's scrolling at the bottom of our screen is not the news. He said, do you want to hear real news? He said, more people on this planet are living under democracy than any other time in the history of the planet. That's real news. And he went on to cite lots and lots of good things that are happening in our world that just doesn't come to our awareness. And you feed that into humans with these big frontal lobes who have problem-solving brains anyway. And it's not a pretty formula.
Yeah, one of my colleagues at Villanova, Matt Kerbel, wrote a book, When It Bleeds, It Leads. And yeah, that's everything's filtered through the media that way. And I think it feeds this collective sense that we're not what we used to be as America.
Yeah, and we get together and we talk about how afraid we are. And we know if we can get a real narrow, narrow lens, we know about mirror neurons now and how anxiety feeds anxiety. It's highly contagious. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary on the line. Mary? I guess we don't have Mary on the line. I want to come back to you, Jody, about creating more connected communities, more, I guess, healthier, more trustworthy communities. You've talked about creating a community vision. Is that similar to a community identity? And how can a community's identity be changed?
Well, a community as a whole should always be aware of, you know, who they are, what their focus is and what that emphasis is. And often when I do work with communities and we're talking about creating a shared vision for their community, I'm finding more and more that people are mentioning this notion of setting some goals or taking some actions towards the people factor within communities. It's not always about the built capital and the financial capital and all those infrastructures that we have in place, but more and more they're bringing up this notion of the people within the community, celebrating the culture of their community. And so it's interesting to begin seeing that shift as communities start thinking about how they might build the social capital aspects of their community and setting some goals to say, and this is how we're going to do that.
Who gets that started? Say, one of the natural leaders in the community or a couple of neighbors?
Sometimes I think it comes, every community is different. I always say, once I've seen one community and visited one community, I've met one community. So I just preface that. Sometimes it is an individual with an idea. Sometimes it is a group of people coming together saying, we really need to make a difference here. Sometimes it's coming through the elected leadership who are feeling a responsibility for looking at their community and wanting to make it something better.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Diane on the phone. Hey, Diane. Diane? I wonder if we're having phone
problems. Or I scared them away.
It's a lack of social connections.
I don't know. It's a lack of phone connections. We'll try that again. I want to get to the subtitle of your book, Brian? Counting Buried Treasure.
Yeah. When I entered this area, I was struck by the fact that we had enormously detailed data about, for example, economic realities. You know, people on the street can quote you the unemployment rate, sometimes the inflation rate when we have any. And, well, crime statistics, you know, for some of the reasons we've already discussed, there are voluminous data on crime. But when you get to the basic question of how is American society doing, there's not so much readily available information. My book tries to make it available. You know, what are we doing in our work lives? What are we doing in our family lives? What are we doing in actual fact, not fear, in terms of voluntary association?
That's the buried treasure?
Yeah, my job was to unbury it so we could look at it and see if there actually has been a fundamental change in American society. And just the way we look at crime statistics on the bad side, we could look at the good side of social capital and make an accounting of it rather than just have an opinion or some free-floating fear.
So have you always leaned towards optimism, half full? Is that the lens through which you begin your studies?
I don't think it's just my personal mood. I've been a social networks guy for a long time, and yeah, the information there is very bracing. I mean, the evidence is that people with bigger, more active social networks are simply better off in virtually every measurable way.
It seems to me, Jody, that the people with bigger networks are the ones who are the most attractive, not physically, but their personality are the most attractive. They're the most inviting. I wonder if there's a way to help those who are less attractive. You know, I'm using a clumsy word here, but it's one who attracts others. Some do and some don't.
I agree that some do and some don't, and that's maybe a part of what goes on. But I think even deeper than that, one of the things that I believe is core to those building those connections and inviting people in is people's self-efficacy. Their belief that they can even make a difference. When people believe they can make a difference, whether it's in their family, in a community group or organization they're a part of in the broader community, if they feel they can make a difference, they are more willing to reach out and be more inviting. Like the example I gave with the friend who moved into a community and said, I'm going to take it on myself. I can make a difference here. I'm going to invite people to my house since I'm not being invited to theirs. Whatever that might be, it's that sense of I can make a difference. And that, if we could build that in everyone, that would be very exciting.
I'll tell you how we can. How's that for an arrogant statement? I know because, I don't know if you know this about me, I'm a quadriplegic. So I was in my hospital bed 32 years ago, and you can imagine how worthless and useless and impotent I felt. And everybody was telling me I had value. I had a lot of friends. Everybody was telling me I had value, I had worth, that I was needed, and I didn't believe it. I just thought everybody was saying it to make me feel better. And then a nurse asked me to help her. And I did. I listened to her story, and I understood her story, and I was able to make a recommendation. And it was because of her that I knew I could make a difference, because she asked something of me. She didn't give anything to me. She asked something of me. And I highly recommend that if you're looking to help someone, ask them to help you. And that'll forge a relationship. Have the courage and the commitment to a relationship to ask them to do something for you. And it was a very powerful lesson, and it changed figure and ground for me.
You're making me smile as I'm listening to you share that, because when I'm working in communities, the last message I like to leave with them is this. a reminder that social capital is built through hundreds of actions. It can be large things, it can be small things that each one of them take every day. Just to say that everyone can be a builder of social capital, and it's asking, it's drawing people out, it's whatever that might be, that each person can make a difference.
So it's done with acts of kindness and care. How many friends do you have, Jody?
Oh, I wouldn't even know how to begin counting.
Yeah, good for you. Brian, how many friends do you have? I know you're a professor, so that number can't be real.
Yeah,
big.
That does limit things a bit. I'd say about half a dozen. And yeah. There's some complexity, the kind of complexity that can't come through my book. Some of my best friends are my brothers. But certainly a bigger social circle than in the American Sociological Review article you were worried about.
Yeah. You have connections, social connections, organizations, or is it a lot through school?
Well, I'm a member of a karate club, Philadelphia School of Korean Karate, shout out. Some professional associations. Pretty typical profile to what we see in the book.
Karate.
Yes, sir.
I would have treated you differently had I known, but...
That's too late now.
Okay. Well, we have to close. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been an important show, and I think informative. Brian, professor of sociology at Villanova, written Social Capital in America, Counting Buried Treasure. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Dr. Dan.
And Jody Hornfett is a community vitality, leadership, and civic engagement educator at the University of Minnesota Extension. And look up their website. It's really fascinating. Jody, thanks so much for taking the time.
I thank you as well. This has been a great opportunity, and I'm taking new ideas away myself, so I do appreciate that.
Wonderful. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be addressing stepfamilies and the complications that arise and what to do about them. Well, you can reach us at whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mike and Scott is our executive director. Our producer is Jennifer Lynn, and me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends, with your friends.